I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Adriana Alfaro, assistant professor of political theory at ITAM. We're discussing her 2021 book, The Belief in Intuition, Individuality and Authority in Henri Bergson and Max Scheler, from the University of Pennsylvania Press. Her research explores questions regarding power, law, and human agency as they appear in modern and contemporary political thought. She has published several articles on these topics. So first of all, Adriana Alfaro, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here.
Adriana, love the book. It was a great examination of two lesser known political philosophers, certainly well to the political theory community anyway, Bergson and Max Scheler. In addition, it was a great application of their theories to contemporary liberalism with a lot of sort of rich, suggestive things that you say about contemporary liberalism that I'd love to talk about in a few minutes. So first of all, thanks for the book. Let me ask you, first of all, what motivated you to write this book in the first place? Why did you choose these two thinkers?
There are two different ways of answering this question. The first is more anecdotal, the second more philosophical. So the first time I saw Max Scheler's name was on a Heidegger book, his Kant and the Problem Metaphysics. Heidegger dedicated that work to the memory of Scheler, saying that the content of the book was the subject of the last conversation they had had, in which Heidegger was, and I'm trying to quote here, allowed to feel the unfettered power of Scheler's spirit. That's how he expressed himself. And in another place after Scheler's death, Heidegger said that he had been, Scheler had been the strongest philosophical force in Germany and perhaps in contemporary Europe and even in contemporary philosophy as such. So those are remarkable statements and made me curious about Scheler. In the case of Bergson, I had read him in college, but just a little bit. And what later got me interested was that Hannah Arendt, in her book, The Life of the Mind, says that Bergson was the last philosopher who believed in intuition. And according to her, that allowed him to understand freedom in a way most modern philosophers were incapable of. So that's how I started reading them, as if at the suggestion of Heidegger and Arendt. But then I think one of the valuable things that I ultimately found in them and made me want to write a dissertation on them, because the book, it comes from my dissertation originally, is how they both in the early 20th century articulated an important critique of Kantianism, while at the same time allowing for a rediscovery of what is, to my mind, richest and most profound in Kant. So in particular, insights about what it is to be free, the meaning of human agency, and how these questions relate to our cognitive capacities. So that's how it all started.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, speaking as someone who completed a book on Kant and liberalism, you know, I mean, the way in which, you know, kind of neo-Kantian pervasiveness of neo-Kantianism in contemporary political philosophy is has gotten, at least to my mind, somewhat stultifying, and sort of, you know, efforts to move beyond the kind of Rawlsian or Habermasian approaches to that draw on Kant in a kind of traditional way are, you know, really useful. And I found that in your book for sure. So this is, you know, I feel very much of an affinity to your project in this way. let's just start with the fundamental concept that you are dealing with here, the idea of intuition. Maybe you could just start out by talking about what intuition means in your book.
Yeah, so perhaps it is useful to distinguish what Bergson and Shaler understood by intuition, both from a couple of ways in which the word is used in contemporary political theory, as well as from the way the concept is used in Kantian philosophy. So first we have the conception of moral intuitions as used in Rawlsian debates, right? Which refers, as we know, to our considered convictions and judgments about particular instances or cases, which we, of course, then later revise later in light of principles and rules that we believe to ground them in order to reach the reflective equilibrium. So that's the first one. The second one is used by so-called ethical intuitionists, according to whom intuitions are basic, self-evident moral propositions, such that they can be known without the need of any argument. Now, in Kant, so intuition is a difficult concept, and it refers to an objective representation, which, unlike a concept, is singular and is immediate, right? So not the sensation I get from, say, seeing or touching this microphone here, right here, but its representation as this singular object, and not this object insofar as it pertains to the type of objects called microphones. So neither of this corresponds to intuition in either Bergson's or Shaler's sense. So convictions and judgments about the morality of particular actions, as in intuitions and roles, as well as self-evident moral propositions, as in intuitions and ethical intuitionism, are objects of thought or understanding. In the case of Kant, intuition is what he calls an objective representation, something we cognize and then is tied or connected to a concept. Instead, for Shaler and Bergson, intuition is, first of all, a human ability or a human power. It is distinct from both reason and sensibility because it addresses something that is neither rational nor sensuous. The way Bergson puts it sometimes is that intuition aims at something ineffable and immaterial, something that slips away at the philosopher's attempt to see it and grasp it. So it is an ability, it is a power, and not something that we cognize or something that we then tie to a concept. And so what I want to say in the book is that this notion of intuition in Bergson and Shaler translates first into a conception of freedom that compared to the modern view focused on the sovereignty of the will becomes more capable of coping and coexisting with a hierarchy, with uncertainty, with alterity. Second, but what I want to say is that such a conception of freedom can only be predicated of a self that remains true to its inner multiplicity. And such inner multiplicity is also something we have access to through intuition in their sense. And this is, of course, a critique of the liberal notion of the self. They put forward a deep or a dense conception of the person whose uniqueness makes it into, you know, the privileged side of experience, and whose main way of access to reality resides not in reason, not in sensibility, but in intuition. And just finally, I want to say that the kind of authority best suited to address the individual in their sense with the capacity or the power of intuition as they explain it or as they understand it will be that of another person, right? And that's the way I try to finish the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great overview there. Just to dig in just a little bit on the notion of intuition, because I'm interested in this idea of something that's neither sort of rational nor sensible. The closest I could approximate it or think in terms of was a kind of romantic conception, you know, a romantic experience of the world that is associated with romantic figures. Like, I mean, I think of like Walt Whitman and Walt Whitman's poetry and the way in which he talks about, you know, the infinite material and substance that is the human world and the natural world. It always eludes our grasp and we can always find. So is that, you know, is that romantic? Are these romantic thinkers in a sense? I mean, is this the best way to orient our thinking around this notion of intuition, or they have kind of a different conception?
Yeah, so I think that's that's a fair thing to say, and that's in part because what they're offering is an important critique of Kantianism, right? Bergson said that the critique of pure reason had relegated the human mind to a corner where, and this is a quote, like a schoolboy in disgrace, it could not turn its head around to see reality as it is, right? So yeah, I think it would be fair to say that there's a sort of romantic heritage over there. I'm not sure I would be able to offer right now a comprehensive analysis of the similarities and differences with Romanticism, but I guess the similarities are recognizable, especially in their conception of the person or of individuality and this ineffable and elusive reality whose uniqueness, nonetheless, we perceive directly. So, for example, Shaler says that the perception of the self does not happen, he says, either by hypothesis or by inference, and of course, even less by a metaphysical assumption of a substance. Rather, he says, the only and the exclusive kind of givenness of the person is the execution of his acts, right? And then when he asks, well, what's the relation between the person and his or her acts? He says, well, the best way of putting it is in the form of a question. And he asks, which unitary executor belongs to the essence of an execution of acts that are so different in their kinds, forms, and directions? So it's by way of a question that he offers an answer of, about what is a person and how we can define it, although this is not a definition. And this, I guess, it has some similarities with Romanticism and the, you know, uniqueness, in the uniqueness of the person. Bergson says something similar when he, in his criticism of intellectualism and how language leads to inauthenticity, right? And because it portrays through signs and symbols what originally resists all conceptualization. But I think there might be some tensions as well, and perhaps we can talk about those later when we talk about the idea of authority. But the romantic emphasis on the figure of the genius with originality and authenticity being its hallmarks, that I think is in some tension with the way they conceive exemplarity, at least the way I read them. So I think there are some tensions, but of course some similarities. Yeah.
Okay. That's good. Yeah. Cause I'd love to get there, because I'm also interested in Nietzsche and how Nietzsche, one of the original figures who talked about exemplarity, and he's interested in seeing the comparison contrast there. But I guess one thing to ask at this point in my mind being, because I've had my Kant hat on for a while, and I mean, Kant and Hegel and a lot of these, and some of these German rationalist figures, I think encountered some of, the early romantic movement. And I think one of their main objections to it was something like, how do we understand the sort of normativity of intuition? Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, simply like how can we apply concepts or categories like true and false and right and wrong to intuition, if intuition is something that always sort of always transcends categorization? Hegel, in the preface to the Philosophy of Right, talks about how, these romantic figures are sort of, it's still like an effusion of emotion, if it eludes categorization, if it evades the law, this is a recipe for anarchy, I guess, one way to put it. So I guess maybe you said just say a little bit. I mean, we'll get into obviously this more with the particular top themes that you take up, but is there a way in general Bergson and Shaler think about how, you know, categories of true and false and right and wrong can be applied to, you know, intuition that eludes categorization.
Yeah. So I guess the first thing to say is that, of course, I think that intuition has some, you know, grasp on reality and in that sense, on truth, because that's a point that intuition gives us access to certain parts of reality that would be forever closed if we didn't have this power or this ability. At the same time, as you say, it's I don't think they want to say that they allow us, you know, to make determinate judgments about right and wrong in the way you mentioned. So perhaps a good example is to think about what Shaler says about conscience. So he says that conscience provides one of the most important vehicles for moral knowledge. But according to him, the voice of conscience speaks to each one of us in a personal way. And Shaler says that as this voice becomes clearer and sharper, it must tell each person something different for the same situation. So I know this is very polemical, and but he says that conscience, properly understood, informs us of what is objectively good for each one of us as individuals. This does not mean, in Shaler's view, that universal moral truths that do not exist, or that the voice of conscience is always and obviously accessible. Rather, he proposes that the relation between universalism and individualism regarding moral matters or regarding values is preserved only when every individual submits those values, which she alone can grasp, to special moral cultivation and culture. Though, of course, at some point also he says that that does not, without neglecting universal valid values. So Shaler's effort to combine what we now call moral realism, right? The idea that moral truths exist out there independently from our volition and situation, with the so-called moral particularism, right? The idea that moral action must respond to context and to other contingent considerations in order to be truly moral. Is clear here, is apparent. And for him, moral values exist, although they do not necessarily yield universal laws, nor can universal laws exhaust morality. Moral action requires the translation and adaptation, what Shaler calls cultivation, of these values into the particular situation in which moral agents find themselves. And this is part of what we do in the process in which we acquire self-knowledge. However, self-knowledge is a very difficult thing to achieve. And therefore, the voice of conscience should not be assumed to speak clearly and distinctly to untrained ears, right? So it's not a blank, you know, check to, you know, say whatever you want and do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find Shaler and Bergson, I think, is also fascinating on this, but interesting. I don't want to get into this, but the way in which he combines, right, as you say, kind of moral particularism, individuality, with an account of a kind of hierarchy of values that are real and objective, and combining those two is an interesting feat that I think he. It's well worth attending to. Let me ask just the last question on intuition, just to get us started. One of the things you say in the introduction is about moving towards the political implications of this idea of intuition. You mentioned that this idea of intuition has been taken up in political programs that have encouraged or licensed violence. Maybe you could say a little bit why it is that the notion of intuition can lead in that direction, but why, as Bergson and Shaler develop it, it would not?
You mean the violent implications of this notion?
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, for instance, in the case of Bergson, despite his personal democratic and liberal convictions, his ideas had plenty of contemporary liberal sympathizers and on both sides of the political spectrum, and some of them markedly violent. So for instance, Bergson exerted a fascination among fascists. An example is Mussolini's cultural politics, or famously Sorel in France. And this has been severally documented, and most recently by my colleague Kevin Duong in his book The Virtues of Violence. And there he says, he explains how Bergson in 20th century France was his metaphysical critique of intellectualism and very intellectualized conception of truth was reinvented and translated into a critique of political representation and the quantitative atomism of political citizenship, and how Bergson's metaphysical distinctions between reality and language, between the vital and the inert, was the basis for a criticism, a critique of decadence and political degeneration. So many of his followers despised parliamentary politics, and all those are seen as having potential violent implications. And and of course, there were a lot of people who saw that and accused directly Bergson directly of those things. So, for instance, Bertrand Russell said that Bergsonism was a banal eulogy of activity without purpose, or Sklar, when she said that Bergsonism was an aesthetic substitute for a lost religion and an emotionally unacceptable science. So yes, all those things are there and are real. And I don't know. I don't want to say that that the notion of intuition is a sort of, as I want to read it and as I want to understand it, is sort of safeguard or a guarantee against violence. I just want to say that it is broader than that. That focusing on the complex inner lives that drive human action, as intuition allows, intuition as understood by Bergson and Shaler, as I read them, allows us, leads us to appreciate the moral and empirical limits of certain liberal devices that mean to regulate our actions from the outside. So, I mean, law and rights, insofar as they may lead us to forget about a richer notion of subjectivity and a richer experience of subjectivity, they may be detrimental, for politics as well. So it's sort of expanding the things that intuition can let us see, and not, just going with the stereotype of intuition just is the same as violence or leads to violence.
Good. Yeah. So let's jump into the your different chapters, each one of which takes up a different, we could say, sort of implication, political, cultural, social implication of the notion of intuition. Chapter one takes up the idea of individuality, kind of uniqueness of individuality that both thinkers hold. So this will be good, good follow up on our introductory discussion here. And you frame the chapter in a helpful way, which is of course the first thing that occurs to any political theorist, which is John Stuart Mill's discussion of individuality and on liberty. So I'm glad you started there, because that would have been my first question if you didn't. What's the difference with Mill? So maybe you could just sort of take us through, sort of how Bergson and Shaler, both similar to and different from, Mill's book, The Motivation for Individuality and the Notion of Individuality as it develops it in On Liberty.
Yeah. So later on in retrospective, I was not sure how helpful that was, that framing in chapter one. But the idea is that half a century after Mill wrote On Liberty, Bergson and Shaler also affirmed, of course, the importance of individuality and its significance for human development. But in contrast to Mill, who worried that people tend to undervalue or ignore individuality, Bergson and Shaler worried that that individuality is very easily misconceived or confused or taken for something that it's not. So individuality deserves special consideration for them, not on account of the risk of it becoming, you know, stifled under a despotic government or an oppressive society, but rather because in defending it, we are very prone to pervert it. That's the idea. In other words, that they saw perhaps they saw in the beginning of the 20th century what Adorno and Horkheimer would put more clearly four decades later, namely that the progress of individuation was being done at the expense of individuality, of the individuality in whose name it took place, right? So why is individuality so vulnerable for them? Why can it be safe even at the hands of its sponsors? So what they say is that it has to do with how individuality is related to diversity. So again, a comparison with Mill might be useful. So according to Mill, social diversity is crucial for the exercise of individuality because it nourishes the intellect and reinvigorates our beliefs, right? That's the idea. And in contrast, for Bergson and Shaler, individuality is fragile because diversity is its principal characteristic. And this makes individuality very difficult to grasp. So what is unitary and simple is easier to understand and keep inside. What is multiple is more difficult. And thus defending individuality becomes less of a question, less a question of how to protect it against external threats of control, and more a matter of being able to discern it, not throughout society, but within ourselves. And in Bergson, this primarily means relating to to our past in a certain way, and or learning how to relate to our past in a certain way. And in Shaler, it means discovering the inner hierarchy of value and corresponding feelings that characterize our emotional life.
Yeah, this is. I love this idea. I mean, that, you know, like Mill essentially won. You know, and so we're all millions now and love individuality, mm-hmm. but yet, you know, that raises an additional problem, which is,
yes.
You know, individuality is actually a lot harder than Mill may have suggested that it is to achieve, even in an ideal mm-hmm. million society. And so why is that? Well, it's because, so do I have it right? I mean, just so I understand it, it's because individuality is actually very complex, like, which mm-hmm. is like kind of a paradox, because individuality is oneness or unitary nature, but actually individuality for them is actually contains endless complexity, and presumably it's like a unity amidst diversity too, right? Because you don't, an individual isn't just
correct.
Sort of a grab bag of many different things. So it's a
correct.
Like a little bit like, you know, I think of this again like Nietzsche. I mean, Nietzsche's name came up already, but I, you know, the way in which Nietzsche thinks of the self as an artistic achievement, like that, you know, we put together out of all of these manifold different features in ourselves some kind of whole. And for Nietzsche, that's super hard. I mean, anybody is capable of doing it, but it's extremely hard to do. So do I have that right? Is it like Nietzsche's view in that way, or is it, you know, different than that?
I mean, I think that what you said is correct in terms of the diagnosis is that because it's very difficult to grasp, then even if, of course, individuality, you know, indicates some sort of unity, it is sort of diversity or unity of what's diverse. And of course, diverse in a particular way, not in the way in which, for instance, associationists or associationist psychology proposed, as in, you know, Hume, for instance, right? That we're a bundle of sensations. That's not the idea. So it's different in that sense. But I think what you said is correct. And I guess there are some parallels with Nietzsche. We can perhaps explore them, but I guess in as you described it, it's a fair parallel. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe you could just, the notion of Shaler's notion, the hierarchy of value in the self. I don't know if you want to sort of flesh that. I mean, I'm interested in those two, the two sort of central features, the individuality, sort of hierarchy of value in Shaler is what the individual is looking towards, or, Bergson's, you have a section on the labor theory of value, which is a good appropriation of that phrase. Maybe you could just sort of expand on those two to give us a sense of, what the core of their notions here are.
Yeah. So I said that in Shaler, cultivating individuality is discovering the inner hierarchy of value and the corresponding feelings that characterize our emotion life. And here he proposes the idea that there's, again, according to his moral realism, an objective hierarchy of values. And he says, at the bottom, we have the more, sensible values. They have to do with pleasure and pain. And then we have the vital values, what he identifies as being empirical and corresponding to the whole person, but not necessarily to one function of the person, and not necessarily as localized as pleasure and pain can be. So for instance, here in the vital values, we have the idea of disgust or hunger instead of appetite, right? Appetite is more sensuous, while hunger can be broader and more a predicate of the person and not of the stomach, say. And then the psychic values, and then at the end, top end of the hierarchy, what he calls the spiritual values, we have to do with the good and beauty and the holy. And the idea here in Shaler is that we have feelings which are sort of receptors with which we perceive value. And his whole project is a phenomenology of the emotions, and how if we start distinguishing different kinds of emotions, we are going to be able to see how different emotions point towards different values. And that will allow us to counter all the reductionism that is present in more utilitarian and more hedonistic approaches to morality, and that's his project. And in the case of Bergson, you said that, well, I propose this idea of the alternative, an alternative labor theory of value, and the idea here is that, and maybe the relation with Nietzsche can be better perceived here. So as maybe some of the listeners of the podcast may know, for Bergson, the primary datum of experience is movement and change, right? Hence the centrality of the notion of duration and time for an adequate comprehension of individuality. Now, precisely due to the importance of time in Bergson's thought, in order to understand his theory of individuality, it is important to say something about his theory of memory and about the role that the brain plays in it. So according to Bergson's theory of memory, which is very idiosyncratic, I admit, the past never disappears, right? It is constantly there. And it is never death. On the contrary, it is prone to constant transformation. What he calls the cinematographic illusion makes us think that the past disappears, like the images of the film disappear from the screen. But for Bergson, that is wrong. The past doesn't go away. Instead, he proposes that the past duplicates the present incessantly. And the past is preserved in its entirety. And the job of the brain is not to remember, but to forget, that is to stop perceiving what is past. Again, this is a very idiosyncratic theory of memory. So it might be worth saying a bit more about it. So what does it mean that the past does not disappear. It surely isn't that Bergson harbors any hopes of humanity eventually being able to travel in time or something like that. Rather, Bergson illustrated the coexistence of the past and the present through his famous cone metaphor. So the idea is that we stand at the apex of this inverted cone, which represents the constant accumulation of the past. At each one of its levels, we find the totality of the past, but at different degrees of contraction or expansion. So this cone displays different levels of consciousness at which we experience different ways of relating to our past. Now, for Bergson, the only possible access to individuality is gained by, so to speak, digging tunnels into this cone, exploring the multiple ways in which we can traverse its different levels. In other words, Bergson teaches that the past is of those who mix their labor with it. And the more you appropriate your past, the more you put yourself in a position to exercise individuality. And that's what I have called the Bergson's alternative theory of value. It has some relation to Nietzsche, perhaps, because the idea is that there's a relation between the there's a similarity between the acts of memorizing and relating with our past and the acts of creation. There's a spectrum between memorizing and creation. And so what Bergson wants to say is that as you relate with your past in a more profound and diverse way, you're in a better position to create yourself in the present and create your future, the future into which you enter at every moment. And that notion of individuality as self-creation, which is, you know, made possible because of certain relation with the past, is maybe something that could be similar to certain things that you find in Nietzsche.
Yeah, that's good. It does sound to me to be similar to Nietzsche in that way, which raises a point. I mean, because it does seem to me that Bergson is more similar to Nietzsche than Scheler is. I mean, just on this point, it strikes me that both thinkers affirm individuality, but Bergson, it seems, has a much more historicist account of individuality, that if that individuals craft themselves out of their unique history, whereas Scheler sounds like a very much anti-historicist conception of individuality. But correct me if I'm wrong here, but anti-historicist in the sense that there simply is an objective, a historical realm of value that's out there that individuals ought to access. Maybe that hierarchy changes over time, but nevertheless, it's sort of an objective, you know, ever-present standard that someone like a Nietzsche, or I'm not sure what Bergson would say about it, would sort of object to, given the primacy of movement and change in their thought. What do you think?
I don't know. So I guess that's probably right. I would say that from Scheler's perspective. So he was a philosophically an ambitious man. He died early, but he had this a very systematic project of showing how, yes, there's a sort of, I wouldn't say formal hierarchy, because the whole idea in his critique of Kantianism was that what's true is material a priori. That was the idea. It's material, but it's also a priori. And this hierarchy of values, it pertains to that category. And what is objective and perhaps eternal is the hierarchy itself, but not necessarily what the way. So for instance, the fact that the values of sensibility are lower than the values, the psychic values, right? But not which pleasures, which things we find pleasurable or painful. That can vary. So his system was supposed to allow for variation, both cultural and historical, but still retain the idea of hierarchy and there are things that are preferable, right? Even if what is preferable at any point of time changes. So I think that he would say that he had a very, you know, ambitious project of capable of allowing and, you know, capturing that diversity, both historically and culturally, and still maintaining the reference to the hierarchy. And yeah, I don't know if that would be Nietzschean at all, but
I do think it is. I mean, I think I have a maybe idiosyncratic reading of Nietzsche here, but, you know, Nietzsche has a conception of humanity as over and against animality. Mm-hmm. And human mm-hmm. beings are a combination of human distinctively human qualities and animal mm-hmm. qualities, and he prioritized the human qualities. Thinks the artist, saint, and the philosopher leads a better life than others do because they put the right kind of priority. So yeah, I mean, so maybe the distance isn't so far as I mm-hmm. as I suggest. That's good. That's helpful. Let's talk about chapter two, which mm-hmm. takes, you know, moves from individuality to Bergson and Schaller's conception of freedom and agency. And here the foil is Kant. So we get the Kantian, the critique of Kant, which is good. Get this on the table. that of, you know, Kant's view of course, very famous view of freedom as a kind of autonomy, giving the law to oneself, especially a moral law. Schaller, in particular, you already sort of suggested this already, especially, you know, concerned about the formalism, legalism, and Kant's view that overlooks the phenomenological experience of moral action. And so I was wondering if you could maybe, you know, sort of walk us through your, you know, Bergson and Schaller's view, then alternative view of freedom and agency. You illustrate those views with reference mm-hmm. to two very, very vivid examples. I mean, one is Raskolnikov and Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, which is great. The other one is Kant's, there's an example in the Critique of Pure Reason, Gallows Man example, which I'll let you explain. I could, but, you know, but you explained it. Using Bergson and Schaller, did nice sort of illustrating their views by giving a reading of these two phenomenologies of moral experience. So maybe you could walk us through those.
Yeah, sure. Here I focus on Kant of the Second Critique, and there he famously held that morality reveals us freedom as a fact, right? So we know the moral law first, and then we know ourselves to be free. That is why morality, according to Kant, is the ratio cognoscendi of freedom, right? Because it allows us to cognize freedom. And Kant illustrates this theory with an example, which is now very famous among philosophers, is the example of a man who is demanded by his prince on pain of immediate execution to give false testimony against an honorable person, right, whom the prince would like to get rid of. So this man, famously known as the Gallows Man, is like everybody else, empirically determined by multiple desires and instincts. Yet, Kant says, when our man is presented with a prince's mortal threat, he is capable of overcoming what determines him empirically. Because he says, as soon as he becomes aware of his duty, he discovers freedom. And that is Kant's famous awareness of the ought, right? The famous fact of reason, which obliges us and at the same time makes us discover freedom. So what I do in this chapter is propose a different reading of Kant's mini story, which I approach a bit narratively, even if it's a vignette, really, and not a full story. I approach it a bit narratively as a sort of criminal case with Kant as the main witness, telling us what happened, what the prince commanded, the mental state of the Gallows Man, that the Gallows Man was in, and as if we had to determine, like a detective or a member of the jury, what really happened there, right? So according to my interpretation, in which I use Bergson's phenomenological approach to human action based on intuition, and again, trying to read Kant's report as closely as possible, so it's a closed reading of this passage, the Gallows Man discovers freedom not through the categorical character of the moral law, as Kant eventually concludes, but through the extent to which he experiences his own capacity for action. So, if you don't mind, we can just read three lines of the passage just to remind listeners what the passage
Please
says.
Please do, yeah, sure.
So he said, Kant says that after the prince threatens this man, and I'm reading here, he would perhaps not venture to assert whether he would do it or not, and that is sacrifice himself, but he must admit without hesitation that it would be possible for him. He judges, therefore, that he can do something because he is aware that he ought to do it and cognizes freedom within him, which without the moral law would have remained unknown to him. So my point here, or the whole, you know, phenomenological reading that I offer of this passage based on Bergson's theory of human action, is the reader notice is that there seems to be a chronological priority of the gallows man's unhesitating awareness of his agency. Kant says he must admit without hesitation that it would be possible for him to sacrifice himself, and therefore he judges that he can do it. So a sort of, I could, therefore I can. And only later he judges that he can do it because he ought to do it. The famous, I ought, therefore I can. So I play with the idea that there is an awareness of the could, so to speak, prior to the famous awareness of the ought. And I try to show that this interpretation is plausible based on Bergson's theory of human agency, according to which action must be considered primarily as movement, as a force that unfolds in time. And accordingly, free agency has more to do with the capacity to choose, the fact that the gallows man thought it would be possible for him to sacrifice, with the power to act, than with the menu of options ahead of us. It is more a question of how we choose, unhesitatingly, in this case of the gallows man, than of what we choose. So from a Bergsonian perspective, the gallows man became free, not because he saved an innocent man, although he did that as well, but because acting without hesitation, he became, as Bergson says, wholly present in his actions. So from a phenomenological Bergsonian perspective, it is again not duty what reveals freedom to the gallows man, but rather the experience of temptation. But notice that the relevant experience of temptation here is not to escape the unjust punishment of the prince, but to save an innocent person. The gallows man is a martyr because he's tempted by justice. And that is the first categorical experience, so to speak, that the passage tells us about, even before getting to the moral law, then a line later. So what I want to suggest is that temptation is a ratio cognoscendi of freedom, and that phenomenologically speaking, it enjoys the same ontological status as morality understood as laws.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, seems to me to be Kantian in spirit, though, nevertheless. I mean, maybe I ask you about this, because in the sense that, you know, Kant has a conception, I mean, his conception of freedom is, you know, is complicated, right? But, you know, so he has a conception of freedom that is embodied in Wille, which is the application of the moral law in our will, but also Willkür, you know, that is you know, the ability to choose, right? For, you know, in service of our self-love or in service of the moral law. I mean, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that, you know, what precedes the moral law is an awareness of our, what Kant calls elsewhere, also practical freedom, right? That we have the ability to choose, like unlike animals, we have the ability to choose for our instincts or against them. Yeah, I mean, that seems right, although it seems to me that Kant, you know, like might agree with that.
Yeah, I think it's a different reading of Kant. I mean, by that I don't mean original. I think that reading, well, first of all, and I should say this is the point of departure of my first dissertation and then book. I guess that's part of what Heidegger does in his reading of Kant, a reading based partly in what Shaler called the material a priori. Based on that insight, Heidegger thought that besides the you know, reason and sensibility, there was the power of imagination that was more fundamental in Kant. That's the whole one of the main points of Heidegger's reading of Kant, which I won't go into right now because I wouldn't be able to. But I guess there's Heidegger's reading, and there's more contemporary, more recent readings. So for instance, Lin Mo Yar, who sees the categorical imperative as a sort of easy way of talking about conscience, a more profound phenomenon, the phenomenon of conscience in Kant, and how the fact of reason, the whole literature around the fact of reason, which is a more phenomenological take on Kant. So this is, I guess, chapter two is my version of it, and my try to add to those readings. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to it because I like to think of the, you know, I'm a devotee of the sort of Alan Wood school mm-hmm. of reading Kant, which really just sort of, you know, tries to kind of dismiss a lot of the discussion about transcendental freedom and its basis, and instead turn to more of the anthropological and the practical form of freedom. But the other thing I was gonna point out is that, you know, one of the interesting things here, and this actually, you know, is a nice bridge to the Crime and Punishment too, which is the other part of your chapter. But, you know, the particular kind of example, I don't know if you have any thoughts about this, but the particular kind of example Kant chooses is relevant here, which is it involves the threat of death, right? Kant could have chosen an example where our moral conscience bites us that doesn't involve death, you know, like lying, for example, which doesn't mm-hmm. have any life, some often doesn't have any life or death consequences in different circumstances, but he chooses death. So it often struck me about this passage that what Kant, there's an assumption here that Kant is working with, that, you know, death is actually very deeply revelatory of our freedom, because death is mm-hmm. he's operating, in other words, with kind of a Hobbesian assumption here that death is the summum malum and sort of determines all our phenomenal experience and disposition. And so if human beings are capable of circumventing that which, you know, overcoming that which determines our animal character, then that's a sort of indication of freedom. If it's merely an example about something that's not life or death, well, you can kind of, you know, if it's somebody asks you, do I look good in this shirt or not? You know, and you know, there aren't real consequences to it. Well, it might not be revelatory to your freedom when you have a bite of conscience when you lie to the person, because it just might be, you know, a different form of self-love that's in operation. Does that make sense? I don't know if you have, you know, thoughts about, you know, the particular, you know, the use of death here as an example in this text, and then in Crime and Punishment.
Yeah. So you said Hobbes, but I was thinking that you were going to say something of, you know, the existential character of the moment, which sort of, it, you know, following the reading that I'm proposing, allows us to see not only the end of your life, but also the possibility of transcending, you know, a mere sensuous existence. So I would say so, yes, that the particular way in which the example is set, both including, you know, life in that situation, and also the fact that the prince represents the prohibition, and then the temptation to become free is precisely in running towards death. I think the example is particular in both those ways. Yeah.
Do you want to say anything briefly about the Crime and Punishment side of yeah. things, and what that adds to the story here?
Yeah, but very briefly. So the contrast I intend between the gallows man example and the much more developed story, but properly speaking, the story of Crime and Punishment, Raskolnikov and his adventures. So is that Whereas the gallows man unhesitatingly becomes aware of his agency, right? He sees without hesitation that it would be possible for him. I mean, independently of what he decides, he sees clearly that it's possible for him to sacrifice. The way I read Crime and Punishment is as a series of, you know, hesitating moments in Raskolnikov. He's hesitating all the time. He doubts all the time. He goes back and forth. He wanders through the city. He falls asleep when the time comes to commit the crime. He gets distracted with, you know, the architecture of the city in his way to the crime. So the way I read the novel is a series of hesitating moments. So that what really condemns Raskolnikov in this reading, and this is parallel to what really saves or makes the gallows man free, what really condemns Raskolnikov is not that he committed a crime and he killed this lady, the moneylender, which is perhaps also a bad thing, a serious thing and a bad thing, but the fact that he's unable to connect with his agency. And that's Dostoevsky shows this every moment in the novel where Raskolnikov hesitates and does not know what to do, and he does not whether he should, you know, tell Sonia that he committed the crime, or maybe he shouldn't tell her, whether he should go see his mother or not. He just doubts and hesitates all the time. And what I want to say is that, you know, besides the fact of committing the crime and, you know, the consequence that brings, or what that shows about him, the fact that he was not able to feel his agency with more, with more clarity is what condemns him. And that's parallel to what saves the gallowsman.
Yeah, great. In chapter three, just in the interest of time, move on here. You talk about Bergson. It's a chapter about Bergson and sort of deepening the view of agency as you develop it in the context of, you know, the theme that you take up here is kind of the pervasive uncertainty that characterizes the world in a Bergsonian universe, right? A universe of movement and flux and change. There's no place for certainty, that uncertainty is our condition. And this is often troubling for we moderns, that we seek absolute knowledge, you know, scientific knowledge of the condition of doing anything. And if we don't have that, then often it leads to a sort of cycle of skepticism. But for Bergson, uncertainty provides a kind of opportunity for agency. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can explain, you know, what it is that he finds sort of positive in uncertainty, and how that has implications for his ethical and political theory.
Yeah, sure. So there are two ideas here. First, that the reality that surrounds us sort of mirrors the human agent. And so uncertainty, as a characteristic of reality, provides an opportunity, as you say, to model our agency in a more dynamic, less determined way. So reality as something uncertain gives some flexibility to our agency. So let me put it this way. Uncertainty, as a trait of reality, offends a completely defined and established personality, right? For which only the categorical will suffice. On the contrary, contingency is not necessarily an embarrassing match for what remains supple and unfinished anyway. So if we acknowledge the uncertainty of reality, we can grasp, as you know, by inference, a more deflated and a more flexible version of our own will, and that I say will make us better at dealing with failure, and better to be able to take advantage of unforeseen opportunities and happy fortuity. So that's the first idea. The second idea is that different ways of understanding uncertainty allow us to model our agency differently. So a moderate approach to uncertainty allows us to forge an identity capable of relying on both habit and improvisation, right? Capable of the solidity of routine, but the spontaneity of improvisation. And this kind of personality has clear advantages in dealing with reality. And on the contrary, if our approach to uncertainty is not moderate, if risk, contingency, and insecurity are given a preeminent focus in political thought and personal thought, when they are turned into the main problems to be addressed, we are usually left with two options: either total insurance against risk at the cost of liberty, and here we can think of Hobbes's Leviathan, or the absurdity of experiencing risk for the mere joy of it, as in the intoxication with danger illustrated by the extolment of violence and different versions of nationalism or colonialism, capitalism, etc. Right. So I understand this dilemma of being between a position of total insurance against risk and, life is a risk, let's take it, as a sort of an instability of agency. It shows the difficulty of achieving a middle ground in our dealings with uncertainty, one that neither stultifies agency by reducing it to pure obedience, nor distends it through megalomanian recklessness.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that Bergson's not a devotee of this sort of romantic love of risk. You could kind of contrast them with another figure, here who, is this sort of Nietzschean flair with loves uncertainty because it's the opportunity for us to really exert our agency in the world. But I guess, as you point out, that, that very picture of the sort of heroic application of the will is just this, another reflection of the desire for certainty and stability, right? Because it's an effort to try to make our will stable and assertive in the world, right? So is that the issue? I mean, that sort of heroic picture is another, just the other side of the coin of the desire for certainty. Is that right?
Yeah, and the point, at least the way I want to read Bergson and this topic, is that in the middle of those two sides, there is a kind of personality that is more, middle ground, admits of some uncertainty, but does not get, in love. It's not superly afraid of uncertainty and risk, but it's also not enamored of danger. And this kind of personality has the advantage regarding uncertainty of giving us resources for accepting challenges and taking risks without expecting to be in complete control of an envisaged plan or putting our whole identity at stake. And the idea is that with its help, we would be able to accept the dictates of fortune and deal with them, again, both with the solidity of routine and the grace of spontaneity, and with more flexibility. And that that's what I take from Bergson, this the possibility of this middle ground identity.
Yeah, it strikes me that, I don't know, when reading this and hearing you talk, it reminds me of the pandemic that we're going through. And I didn't know if you had any thoughts about this, but it just, in the sense that the two ends of the spectrum here you're describing strike me as what we've experienced as kind of two pathologies through this. That is, on the one hand, a kind of demand for absolute certainty from science, which has not been forthcoming with, we do know things, but we don't have absolute certainty. But on the other hand, this sort of, reckless sort of cavalier attitude towards masks and vaccines, which is also sort of another pathology here, where, I don't know if you thought about this, but how, Bergson might respond. It strikes me that his attitude towards risk might be a sort of healthier alternative for our times.
Yeah, I mean, I do think so. Although I also think, going through the pandemic, as we all are, that saying that, stating it is easier than actually doing it. So it sounds good, and it certainly has helped me to think, okay, how can I achieve this middle point? But you know, actually facing the dangers and the, you know, desire to also go back to normal and do things that we used to do. And also with all the, you know, uncertain and unclear information coming from science, what I see is that it's, you know, easier said than done. Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. It's no option is easy, I suppose, here. Although maybe it's the toughest, but it's also maybe the healthiest. I'm not sure. I wanted to move on. I'd love to talk about chapter four, but I wanted to skip to chapter five just to make sure we cover it, because it takes on the chapter five, you take up the idea of authority here, which we mentioned already earlier, and its connection with the notion of exemplarity. And so I thought what we could do is just sort of talk through that, because this is in a way the, you know, it's the other part of your book, as it were, which is we've been talking for most of the conversation about Bergson and Shaler's view of individuality and agency, but they also equally have an account of what integrates individuals together, a form of authority that sort of knits society together. And it's also like, we've been discussing a kind of alternative or critique of, you know, standard liberal modus operandi, right? In the way that, just in the way that their view of individuality is a critique of the liberal view of self, their view of authority is also a critique of the standard kind of liberal picture of the rule of law and impartial rule, most importantly, as the most important form of authority through individual forms of consent. Instead, it's a, you know, instead of the rule of law, as where it's, you know, the rule of man, once again, or woman, the idea of particular individual exemplars who represent for them the kind of best way of thinking about authority. Could you develop that idea and why they thought that was the best way to think about authority?
Yeah, sure. So the question I address in this last chapter is, what can authority be in light of the personalist anthropology that they both offer, right? We saw in the previous chapters and in our conversation here that they have this notion of the self or the person, which is thick but not solid. It is thick because they acknowledge it sort of in different ways, but an inner diversity that characterizes true individuality, but it's not solid because they consider this multiplicity to be in some sense ineffable by virtue of their emphasis on movement or action in Bergson and Shaler respectively. So what kind of authority can be claimed on someone whose character is unfixed, right? And always unique, on a self whose innermost essence defies definition? Can such a being be even bound by authority legitimately? And if so, can it remain free? So the idea here is to show that both Shaler and Bergson offer answers to these questions in their respective reflections on exemplarity. And this notion refers to the kind of authority, as you said, that resides in a person whose example appears to have some moral claim on other people. And the reason why this alternative is attractive for people like Bergson and Shaler is double. So first, it is congruent with the ethical and metaphysical centrality they both accord to the person or the inner self. And second, it also agrees with their conception of personal freedom based on action. So the idea is that exemplars have a special claim on persons in the Bergsonian and the Shalerian sense, because they alone provide insights that can properly guide action, movement, without therefore compromising the personality and the agency of those who follow them, right? And this, of course, grows out of their criticism of ethical rationalism and the, you know, formalistic approaches to morality, which according to them cannot preserve what is unique in the self, and therefore authority based on reason, either rational argument or rational deliberation, will not suffice I mean, it doesn't mean that's always bad or that's not useful in any way, but will not suffice to engage the person as such and cannot be an appropriate ground for freedom.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, what occurs to me, of course, right off the bat is, this is often when I make similar moves with Nietzsche, is, you know, the concern is immediately about immoral exemplars, right? So the idea is, what do you do about, okay, it's all well and good for, you know, exemplary people to wield authority. And that's fine when you're thinking about Abraham Lincoln or something. But,
yeah,
you know, if you're thinking about Hitler, who also had a kind of charismatic or, you know, a certain exemplary authority for the people that he followed, it becomes more problematic, right? So that's where the sort of rationalists, this concern about normativity, I think, comes back in, which is, mm-hmm. you know, is this a concern that Bergson and Shaler take up? And if so, what do they, how do they address it? The problem of immoral exemplars?
So I don't think they address it up front. And I guess, for that reason, Bergson and Shaler's reflections will not be able to offer a clear set of criteria that would allow us to distinguish falsehood from truth in terms with respect to prophets, right? And address the problem of very old problem of false prophets. However, I guess that their respective treatments of exemplarity do tell us two things, right? Even if they don't give us an answer to that problem of how to distinguish. And I don't think Rousseau had an answer either. So for instance, right? But first, they show us that we as agents surely have the power to recognize the force of an example. And therefore, they show that not to be attentive to such phenomena would be negligent on our part. And second, and more importantly, perhaps, we learned that given our condition as persons, exemplarity has a privileged place in our moral formation. And also ignoring that would be, to the detriment of our moral development as persons. I think those are the two important insights.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, you also connect this, I mean, to think about the political implications of this, because this is also authority, not just in the ethical or cultural domain, but authority in the political domain too. And you can connect it with, of course, Weber's famous mm-hmm. view of charismatic authority. I wonder if you could say a little bit about how their views connect with, you know, Weberian authority, and whether, you know, this could be conceived of as improvement on or whatnot, a kind of contribution to thinking about Weber, but, you know, and also in relationship with, you know, the way in which charismatic authority has been connected with a kind of populist mm-hmm. politics. I mean, this is obviously something that, in our contemporary age is on a lot of people's minds. That is the force of particular personalities in many cases wrecking havoc on political systems. How do you think about, you know, so the connection between exemplary authority and populism? Is there a way in which Bergson and Shaler's view of exemplarity can create a more responsible form of populist politics? We'll put it that way.
Yeah. So first, talk a bit about Weber. So both Weber and Bergson and Shaler clearly had a shared set of normative concerns that motivated them to turn to personal authority in the modern world, right? So worries about intellectualization, rationalization, bureaucratization, and how those stifle individuality and therefore are sources of oppression. So there's a shared set of concerns there. But then one of the goals in the chapter is to show how they differ and how Bergson's and Shaler's notion of exemplarity is an alternative to Weber's notion of charismatic authority. And we might remember that Weber conceives of charismatic authority as that which rests on devotion to the specific and exceptional sanctity, heroism, or exemplarity of an individual person, and devotion to the normative patterns that he or she ordains. According to Weber, these normative patterns find no other ground outside of the leader's own extraordinary qualities, which are acknowledged through constant proofs that confirm the possession of charisma, right? And he also observes that charisma can only be awakened and tested, but it cannot be learned or taught. He also says that the message conveyed by those with charismatic authority involves, for both the prophet himself and the followers, a unified view of the world derived from a consciously integrated and meaningful attitude toward life. So the allure of the charismatic leader in Weber resides in the fact that he or she reveals or ordains normative patterns that are capable of giving coherence and constancy to a life, to a personality in Weber sense. I think now, I mean, with this brief summary, we can start to see the differences with Bergson and Shaler. First, that Weber's conception of personality has this element of unitary individuality, which is in stark contrast to the multiplicity that characterizes Bergson and Shaler's notion of the self and the person. The idea of this unitary individuality is that it gives a pattern of behavioral propensities and character dispositions that lead to coherent action and to purposeful teleological action. That's the idea in Weber. And here we have a very, very different notion of the person. So as we have discussed right now, for Bergson, for Shaler, this multiplicity of the inner self is betrayed as soon as it is given concrete meaning, right? Free agency is ineffable as well. And in Weber's conception of freedom, in which, yes, heterogeneity is certainly acknowledged at the outset, then is given up, so to speak, through choice, right? Weber says that freedom is found in the conflict of different gods, in the conflict of values, among which a person must choose in order to make sense of the reality that surrounds her. Notice then that the difference between the respective conceptions of personality and freedom are of an epistemological nature. They correspond to Weber's post-Kantian skepticism and to Bergson and Shaler's belief in intuition, right, respectively. So, given such contrasts, the kind of personal authority that can effectively speak to the person in each case will vary accordingly. Right? First, as I said before, Bergson's conception of exemplarity is not concerned at all with dogma, Shaler's either, or with a unified worldview. For them, the allure exerted by the great mystics or by the saints, which are the two examples of exemplarity that they take, those of the saints, of the mystics, of the in Shaler's and Bergson's case respectively, the allure that they exert does not depend on either handing down specific commands or revealing to others a concrete set of directives. Of course, this does not mean that actual recognition by others is dispensable. That is important. But for Bergson, recognition is something that we can learn how to develop. And it's not awakened suddenly, as in the case of Weber, as we recognize charismatic authority. So in the case of both Bergson and Shaler, recognition is a gradual process, a gradual education of the senses, right? So I think there are important differences, even though the set of normative concerns that push them into the direction of exemplarity are similar.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, if I understand you right, that the Weberian view is, of authority is much shallower. I mean, it appeals to emotion, and it's it takes away the liberty of the the followers of the charismatic authority. It's more, it's populist in more of the pejorative sense, whereas, you know, the Bergsonian and Schellerian view of exemplarity actually liberate, you know, it's deep, it's complex as opposed to shallow, and it liberates the followers rather than sort of enchains them to the to the will. It educate or educates them is the other way that you put it. I would line up Nietzsche on the latter side, by the way, despite Weber's much more, you know, like apparent claim to the Nietzschean mantle. But in any case, it's a conversation for another time, I guess. Let's conclude by just talking about your conclusion, which you take up some of the pathologies of liberalism in the late modern age here and sort of apply Bergson and Scheler's views of individuality and authority here. I thought we could just, you know, you could just briefly sort of sketch them and see where this takes us. But, you know, particularly, I wanted you to say a little bit about your very suggestive discussions about, you know, this sort of digital life of the self in, especially as, you know, online, the way in which Silicon Valley, you know, commodifies and micro targets individuals, mm-hmm. turning us into ones and zeros. Maybe you could just, you know, discuss the challenge, you know, how this is, you know, a challenge that kind of liberalism itself is ill-equipped to take up on its own, and how maybe, you know, Bergsonian and Schellerian views could help us here.
A topic that personally interests me a lot. So I guess that all the contemporary concerns about the commodification of the self, right? We find that in, so for instance, in the work of Richard Seymour, the Turing machine and all the implications that, you know, social media has in how we relate to others and to ourselves. Or the fact that we are, you know, literally being commodified by what Zuboff has called the age of surveillance capitalism, and how in that sense, the worries that perhaps Adorno and Horkheimer had a few decades ago are back with a vengeance, so to speak. One of my hopes, I guess, is that this conception of a thick but not solid, a more profound and diverse and ineffable conception of the self could, you know, suggest that we cannot that there's some shallowness in, you know, curating identity, as in, for example, we do in social media, and that personality cannot be reduced to identity, which is one of the important topics today, like identity politics and how we pursue freedom by protecting certain identities or by protecting the freedom of expression that belongs to certain identities. And so my hope is that this perspective on freedom, which sees us as more ineffable and, you know, difficult to capture, allows us to see the limits of those resources, identity politics, rights, loss, if what we want is to approach, you know, the richness of subjectivity. And of course, this does not mean to say that that things like, you know, freedom of expression and certain rights, you know, like that, or that, you know, the protection of certain identities are not important, but that we should not make those symbols of our freedom, because as such, they're sort of verified, right? They're sort of frozen. If what we do is talk about our freedom in those terms, and that's part of what I want to say. And just very briefly, to go back to your questions about populism, because I didn't address it, I guess that what I look for in Bergson and Scheler's respective conceptions of exemplarity is to show that liberalism would only at its own peril deny the anthropological, moral, and political importance of, you know, those charismatic figures, as we know them, right? Who, in the famous words of Rousseau, can compel without violence and persuade without convincing. And so that's a reminder. I don't know if that would, you know, be enough for a more, you know, a healthier practice of populism, as you put it. But it's a, I guess it's a healthy reminder.
Yeah, well, you conclude with a sort of a call for humility, which is interesting. And I mean, I take it to be a, you know, an effort in this direction, that, mm-hmm. you know, an effort to, you know, I mean, because one tendency with this notion of exemplarity and populism is an idea of hubris and excess, mm-hmm. right? A kind of Dionysian excess. But instead, you know, Bergson and Shaler help us move in the other direction, which is more towards a way from forms of self-assertion, which, you know, the emphasis on freedom might take us, but in the direction rather kind of self-effacement in the form of humility. And you can just conclude by just talking about, you know, what you think the political possibilities for humility in the liberal age are.
Yeah, so it's interesting that they both, Bergson and Shaler, in their reflections of exemplarity, focus on the figure of Imitatio Christi. What they say is that in this figure, we can find some of the benefits of you know, personal authority, but without the disadvantages or perils associated with hubris, right? So the idea is that Imitatio Christi is a pedagogical resource that can teach us how to emulate admirable, exemplary people who exert an extraordinary pull on others, and that in the midst of the all the fears associated with charismatic and personal authority, we would do well to turn to imitation as a political pedagogical resource that, on the one hand, focuses on what on the individual, but also sort of displaces this, you know, vanity tendencies to have a name, to be the first one, to be the most, you know, visible of all figures. And they both find in the theological reflections about around this figure or this idea of Imitatio Christi, the interesting political pedagogical resources for their age, at least. And my point is that the comeback of humility within democratic theory might suggest that it also, this kind of figures, theological figures, have also interesting secular implications or advice for our age.
Well, that's great, Adriana. This has been a great conversation, a great, great book to read. So thank you again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
No, thank you for the invitation. I love the conversation as well. Thank you, Jeff.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.